Okay, obviously it's very nice to have all returning alumni with us for this year. Okay, one of the things we'll discover today is how, again, analysis in one area can spill over to help our understanding of a different area. Because we're going to start in the realm of issues having to do with women and mitzvot, women and commandments. But, sorry to disappoint you, it's actually not going to be a shiur about women. It'll be more a shiur about the nature of meal of circumcision and time-bound commandments. Okay, so let's start just with a little bit of background. Okay, so we know there's a rule that women are often exempt from time-bound commandments. Okay, however, as rules go, it's not one of the more universal rules in our tradition. You know, not every rule is universal. It's like saying all the right to guys like endless singing of Ashrei. It's not a universal rule, right? There are exceptions. Okay, so here too, there are several mitzvot which are time-bound that women are commanded in. Just to name a few, what are time-bound mitzvot that women are commanded in? Okay, obviously, Kiddush on Shabbat, right, eating matzah on Pesach. So there are many exceptions. Nonetheless, despite all those exceptions, we do tend to treat it as a rule. Okay, so now there's a Gemara in Kiddushin that's a bit surprising based on that. Because the Gemara in Kiddushin is describing parental obligations to children. And it says that one of the parental obligations of a father is to ensure that his son is circumcised. And then the Gemara raises the question, is the mother similarly obligated? And it derives from Psukim, it derives from verses that, but if anyone needs more sheets, there are a couple more sheets over here. Okay, it derives from verses that a woman is not obligated. Actually, let's do a little, maybe biblical review for a second. Okay, where are the three places that circumcision comes up in Sefer Bereishit? Three places. Okay, Jordan, what do you say? Which Avram chapter are you thinking of? You don't have to name the chapter by number, because what's happening?
Right before the guests.
Okay, so in Perek Yudzayin, very good, Yoni. Right, who gets Brit Milah in that chapter?
Avram and
Yishmael. Okay, great. Jonah?
Is that kind of two?
Okay, very good. That's the one I wasn't sure people would get. Right, that's the trick that Shimon and Levi play on the people of Shem, worthy of its own analysis. And third one? Very good. And Yitzchak gets a Brit as well. Okay, excellent. Okay, so in the context of Yitzchak's circumcision, it says, Avram took care of it, kasher tziva oto elokim. And the heavy emphasis on tziva oto, he was commanded, implying he was commanded and not Sarah. So that's the Talmudic source that the obligation to circumcise the son is on the father and not the mother. And at that point, all the commentators ask, you didn't need a special derivation of this principle. You could have just done the general principle of women being exempt from time-bound commandments, with the assumption of the question being that meal of its circumcision is in fact a time-bound commandment. Okay, everybody got the question down? So the Gemara is a specific derivation, because it says, kasher tziva uto. And the question is, why do we need a specific derivation if you have a larger principle of mitzvah asei shezman of time-bound commandments? Now let's just think for 1 second. In theory, what would make Mila a time-bound commandment? There's actually three possibilities. Why would Mila be viewed as a time-bound commandment? Okay, Sam, what do you say? Okay, A, you wait till the 8th day, right? You're not supposed to circumcision on days 1 through 7. What else? Okay, day and not nighttime. Maybe, right? Even though they're in Israel, the one thing you'll find funny about Israel versus America, you know, in America, every Brit you ever had is always at like 7 in the morning. You ever notice that? Only in Israel do you have a circumcision call for like 3 in the afternoon. You always wonder, like, Israelis don't work. Like, why is that? But, okay. Be that as it may, a Brit is always in the morning and the afternoon, right? It's not at nighttime. So maybe that's what gives it its time-bound quality. Okay, so the 8th day, day and not night. Okay, the third one's a bit more obscure. What might be a third factor that can make it a time-bound mitzvah? Oh, we've stumped everybody here. Yeah, Jordan.
Wasn't it more of like a habanim that if you didn't do it, you wouldn't be able to make it up? Or is it like a habanim?
Okay, but I think you can go a different way. Henry, what do you say?
Has to be on a weekday.
Ah, very good. Okay, now what about weekday versus Shabbat? Now here you have to be, it's a little bit tricky, because a lot of you will protest now, Henry's point. Well, you protest? Because you can give a Brit Milah on Shabbat, except what's the limitation of that?
If you don't do it,
only when it's on the 8th day proper. Okay? If it's on the optimum day, that overrides Shabbat, overrides the Sabbath. We'll do it on Shabbos. Once it's delayed, let's say it's delayed for medical reasons. So at that point, the difference between the 13th and the 14th of the boy's life is not so significant, once it's not on the essential day. And we would not have the breed on Shabbat. At that point, we would wait for Sunday. So it is tricky, there's Henry's point, because there could be a breed on Shabbat, but once you're beyond the 8th day, again, there would seemingly be a time limitation. Okay, so we could explore Brit Milah as a time-bound mitzvah now from three perspectives. It could be time-bound because you wait for the 8th day. It could be time-bound because it's in day and not the nighttime. It could be time bound because after a certain point, you will not do it. Yes, Jacob.
I challenge the fact that it's only an obligation on the dead.
Sure.
Because the Gemara Yerushalmi says that with true oil, that a baby, you're not allowed to have true oil on a baby that's in the seventh, Kohen baby that's in the seventh day, the night of the eighth day, because it's already considered an oil.
Okay, so I think your point will come back later, okay? Where is your knowledge of Yushalmi coming from, Jacob Ruffin?
Yushalmi.
Okay, Jacob, is it okay if I tell everybody about the movie?
Of course.
Okay? Yeah. Guys, we have a great idea this year that we're going to put out Jacob Rocklin teddy bears. Okay? And they have great features because if you squeeze the stomach, it complains about yeshiva. It's great. We'll leave that the rest. Okay. Okay, excellent. Okay, so in theory now, we could investigate the three specific questions, each individually, like maybe the individual answers to the questions, or maybe there's some global perspective why Zman Grama, time-bound constraints, don't apply to meal at all. So maybe it makes sense to start with the individual approach, and then we'll get to the global approach afterwards. Okay, so let's see if we can solve some of the individual questions. Okay, so let's start with perhaps the most technical one. Okay, let's go to Tosfos and Kiddushin. Okay, Tosfos and Kiddushin is going to raise two of the three. So Tosfos says, Yim Tomer Lamalikra, why do I need a biblical verse? Typically, the mitzvah I say is Man Gramu. It is just a time-bound commandment. Shenimo b'shmini l'leidato v'nashim b'tirot, right? Why don't we say, because it's the eighth day, it has a time-bound element. V'yesh lomer kim demyom b'shmini l'hala ein lehafseik lavs Man Gramu. So how does he try to deal with, or they try to deal with the eighth-day problem? What's the claim? But once you get to the eighth day, it stays forever. You could get a circumcision at any point in your life, so therefore it's not time-bound. Okay, we'll delve into that a bit more later. What about, now he moves to another factor. It's limited to the daytime. So obviously this is not such an exciting answer, but it would solve one of the three problems. What's the claim here in Tosfot? That once you're past the eighth day, you could do it at night. So obviously, if the question is you can only do it in the daytime, it's time-bound. So if you think you can do it in the day and night, so obviously that would fade away. Okay, so that is a way of solving, again, but the narrow issue of one of the three problems. Okay, maybe we'll go to another, perhaps narrow solution for a second. Let us go to... Let's turn the page, actually. We'll go to some famous Achronim. Okay, let us go to the Sfas Emes. Okay, again, Harry Kramer, who's the Sfas Emes? The Ger Rebbe, excellent. Okay, remember guys, he's a great Pirshan Shas. Okay, the Sfas Emes is going to raise a couple of our questions and have, again, individualized answers. Not a sweeping answer, but an answer to the individual problem. Okay, let's see what we have in the Sfas Emes here. Hikshu lamet sarach oto lamayri shash ena chever lamo b'na teke leik zman grami kim demila ena b'layla. Okay, yesh makshin lamet lo hikshu atosu b'pshit today zman grama hov shalom b'zman ena dochas shabbat. Oh, here we go. Okay, so most of the commentators, you notice, they raise the day-night question, or they raise the eight-day question, right? Not so many people raise the Shabbat question, probably because you can do a meal on Shabbat if it's the eighth day. But he does raise the question. Once it's after the time, you can't do it on the eighth day anymore. So look what he says. He has some very sharp answers. Shabbat, lo miki b'zezman grama, ga mitzvah l'olam mutalet gam b'shabbat, Rak Yisur de Shabbat Docha Mitzvah. Okay, that's a great point. Let's take you a step back for a second. Where do we see in our tradition that not applying on Shabbat renders you Zman Grama, renders you a time-bound mitzvah? So where do you see that? Tefillin. So the paradigm is Tefillin, right? Tefillin, in theory, would not be a Zman Grama mitzvah. So no, since there is no mitzvah to wear Tefillin on Shabbat, right, that's why it is a time-bound mitzvah. Okay, great. But, so now, says the Sfas Emes, why do you say the same thing? We don't wear Tefillin on Shabbat. It is time-bound. So if we don't do a Brit Milah on Shabbat after the eighth day, it's also a time-bound mitzvah. So why are they not the same? Yeah, Jonah K?
Well, I'm just questioning
yeah. So the truth is, that is raised also as a possibility, but the Gemara does also suggest the fact that it's not on Shabbat. Okay, so you're right, you could have other grounds for it being time-bound, but this seems to be adequate grounds. So what's the difference? Zach? Yeah, why don't we wear tefillin on Shabbat? No, but not because... Yeah, not because it's forbidden. There's no problem. It's not in one of the 39 categories of work that we avoid on Shabbat. It's simply that it is not necessary on Shabbat. In fact, it's not even obvious that it's forbidden. Maybe you watch the halacha regarding tzon. You don't have to wear them on Shabbat, but you could. Now, granted, that's not our contemporary practice, but in theory, you could say that. So what does that mean? That means that the mitzvah of tefillin, right, is there on Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. Shabbat comes, what happens all of a sudden? There's no mitzvah anymore. So it is a time-bound commandment. Okay, how about what happens when we get to Mila? What happens when Mila intersects with Shabbat? Why don't we do it? Okay, but once it's not the eighth day, why don't we give a Brit Mila on Shabbat? Because it's Usher. Right, one of the things we don't do on Shabbat is make a wound in a human being. Right, that is one of the 39 categories of work we don't avoid on Shabbos. So at that point, we don't do it. But what does that mean? So here I think it's a very sharp conceptual point. Sometimes you don't do a mitzvah because the mitzvah is not in play. Sometimes why do you do a mitzvah? Not because it's not in play, but it conflicts with some other halakhic value. But that doesn't mean that we've canceled the mitzvah. There's a difference in life between saying the mitzvah has ceased, the mitzvah is not operative right now, or the mitzvah is operative, but it loses. Like, as I always say, guys, most values in life lose at some point, right? One value always wins, right? Every value at some point breaks down in the conflict with a different value. But that doesn't mean it's not in play. So I think the Sfat Emet is a very sharp point here, which is that tefillin indeed stops being a commandment on the Sabbath, right, on Shabbat. And therefore, at that point, it's a time-bound commandment. But Mila never stops. It's just what happens. It loses out. You know what? I'll give you a great analogy, guys. This is a good analogy. Okay, I didn't think of this before, but it just occurred to me. Okay, so you know in many families there's tension about whether to get a dog or not. Okay, you know, the kids want to get a dog and the parents don't want to get a dog. And the kids say, don't worry, Dad, I'll take care of it. You'll never have to do anything. Right? 24 hours later, you see Dad walking the dog outside at night. Okay, it's very obvious. Okay? So we've resisted. But my wife has an aunt and uncle where the uncle lost out. Right? He was very adamantly opposed to a dog. And lo and behold, they have a dog for the last 20 years. And my wife's uncle is not so easy to overcome. Right? So I said to him once, Uncle Mickey, I'm so surprised you gave in on the dog. He said, I didn't give in. I was defeated. Okay? Which is a difference. Right? You know, he was there. Right? The opposition was there. Just sometimes you lose out in the opposition. Right? So that's what you have over here. Right? The mitzvah of Mila is always in play. It's in play on Shabbat also. It's just that it loses out to Shabbat. Yeah, David.
So what is it about having Mila on its like eighth day that goes over the...
Okay, very good. So David's right. But I think the interesting question now would not be why after the eighth day does Mila not override Shabbat? Now, Dave's right. You could shift the question to why is it obvious that on the eighth day Mila does beat out Shabbat? So that's an interesting question that requires its own analysis. You're right, because not so many things in our tradition beat Shabbos. But Mila does beat Shabbos. That's quite fascinating why that's true. Yeah, Yoni.
So what's the implication of the difference between two and three?
No, so the implication is that fill in, you have to think of as a mitzvah with time limitations. For whatever reason, you're not really, right, once Friday night kicks in, right, tefillin ceases to be a mitzvah. It's just not a significant religious act anymore. Mila would still be a significant religious act, but it loses out to the prohibitions of Shabbat. So that's why it's not time bound. Correct. Okay, have we got the answer down? Okay, great. It's a good answer. See, Yoni Gelfand appreciates the answer. Excellent. Okay, so now, let us skip to a second answer. Okay, this I think is a very... we shouldn't do this yet because I'm trying to avoid the global answers. Sorry. We're not going to get to the second part of this last MS because that's a global answer. We're trying to do the individual answers and get to the global answer at the end. Okay, one more individual answer. Let us go to source 7. Okay. Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, famous founder of the Brisker Derech. All the Briskers, and we're very excited now. The eyes, are you excited?
Yes.
Okay, great. Okay, so here we go. So just so you'll be aware, the Soloveitchiks were very big perfectionists. And therefore, they didn't publish very much. In fact, Reb Chaim Soloveitchik basically only published one work, okay, which really came out, I think his sons put it out after he passed away, which is his commentary on the Rambam. Right, that is the work he was involved in publishing. When you ever see Reb Chaim Soloveitchik on Shas, on the Talmud, that is his student's notes. Right, he didn't publish. But I will give you one warning. If you're going to become a famous person and you don't like publishing, I'm going to tell you you should publish anyway. Because what's obviously going to happen if you don't publish? So somebody else will publish your ideas. So it's not as if it'll be, oh, it'll be out there, it won't be out there. So the question is what control you'll have of what's out there. But be that as it may, let's go to Reb Chaim here. Okay, so he has a clever answer in source 7. Now, he's dealing with the issue of day 8. Now, that was one of our three issues. Day 8 as opposed to before day 8. So if we skip to the second line at the end, he says, Daha havi milia biyom hashmini. Why is circumcision the 8th day? Ein ze mishum de bizman talya milta. It's really not time-bound. El talya beguf havlad. What's it really about? Meaning, you're not waiting for the calendar date per se. What are you waiting? For the baby to be a sufficient maturity. Right, that's what you're waiting. It just happens to intersect or overlap with day. Now, here's a hypothetical. Some of you like this, some of you won't. Day in blood, pachmiz animo. Imayim etziya lomar shi yavlad ben shmoni yamim, beli shavu shmoni yamim. We'll see who likes the lomar, who doesn't right now. Gamka animo, what's the claim? What if you could have a very advanced baby? Right, somehow it managed to speed up the aging process, and in 2 days is now of 8 day physical capacity. What does the Rav Chaim claim at that point? You keep it right, because it's really not about the calendar date per se. Right, it's really about the physical growth of the baby. 1 second, Alec. Okay, but he has a great analogy for this, guys. What's his analogy? See, he says, "Wait, I understand. I'm going to argue actually that every mitzvah in the world is time bound mitzvah." Okay, amazing idea. You okay? We can make every mitzvah time bound. Why is every mitzvah in the world time bound? Well, you're not obligated until you're 13. Lo and behold, they're all time bound mitzvah. So what's the obvious answer? No, it's not that like the mitzvah somehow kicks in when you're 13. It's that you're not mature and responsible enough yet to be obligated. So until you're a legal adult, you're not obligated. Once you're a legal adult, you're obligated. But that's not a time bound mitzvah. That's just waiting for you to be sufficiently mature for the mitzvah to address you. So this you could. So I think that analogy helps understand what Chaim is getting at. Waiting 8 days is not about, oh, this mitzvah has time limitations. It's about when you get sufficient maturity, then we can give a circumcision. Yes, Jacob.
So then why do we wait until 13 then? Why shouldn't it just be different for everyone? Like, if you have this baby to be like physically mature.
Okay, so that's a great question. But realize, guys, there's always a tension in every legal system between wanting things to be subjective and wanting things to be objective. Like, on the one hand, you want to, law should apply to every person's particular. On the other hand, you can't have a separate legal system for every individual. So every legal system is going to have some tendency towards objectification. Right? So we'll say, okay, you know, by the way, you get the same thing in every secular society also, right? In America, you can vote when you're 18, is that right?
Yeah.
Okay. So obviously there's some 16-year-olds who are ready to vote and some 40-year-olds who are not ready to vote. But that's not the way society works, right? We just say, when you're 18, you can vote. So that's the nature of law.
Same would be consistent with our time to say that we should also make people obligated to misvote when they become mature, as opposed to 13, if he's going to be consistent and about bringing off.
No, but Reb Chaim does not concede. Guys, Reb Chaim's possibility is really hypothetical. Like, he does not envision ever ruling that, oh, this baby's so mature, you could give him a 3 day circumcision. Right? It's more just to hypothetically make the point.
Yeah.
Right? The way law works is we always wait for day 8. But he's pointing out we're not really waiting for a calendar date, we're waiting for a certain physical maturity. Zach?
Then, according to Reb Chaim, why wouldn't you push it off? Because you'd be just as mature on the 9th day as you were on the 8th day, so why not push it off till Sunday? Isn't there some sanctity to the 8th day clearly that you can't break?
No, that's interesting. That's not it. That's a good question. You're saying it can't be that we're just waiting because we were just waiting, then day 10 would be just as good as day 8. Yeah, that's a sharp point. Very good. That's a good question. I'm not sure what the answer is. Okay. Zach Ben Ezra. Too bad Chaim is not here to ask him that question. That's a good question. Okay. Yeah, Kyle.
We find the opposite of this situation a lot, which premature babies.
I'm sorry?
Premature babies can push off.
Okay. What? That helps or hurts?
I think it helps.
Right? Right. The other thing is you could explain otherwise there also. You could just say for medical safety concerns, we're waiting. But you're right, though. There's no magic to the 8th day. Right. If the baby's premature and it's the 8th day, we don't do the circumcision. Correct. Okay, but I still think Zach's question is a good question. Yeah, Alec. Okay, so that gets to a great point, which really is a whole other shiur. Where's Rav David Yehudim? Which is, you know, I'm not sure if I should do this tangent, but I'll do it for 1 second. Okay, you know, briskers like to argue that they deal with the what, but not the why. Okay, you guys have heard this conversation? That the analogy would be like to a biologist, right? A biologist asks what questions, not why questions. Meaning, we have a certain amount of empirical evidence about how the universe works. We're going to come up with a theory that goes with the evidence. If you ask me why should that be true, we say, no, why is not the issue. Right? Ask a theologian why. Right? We just deal with the what. Okay, so one claim about Brisker conceptual analysis is that how it works. You have this legal data. You try to come up with a theory that explains the data. And at that point, as long as the theory explains the data, it doesn't matter if it's counterintuitive or that doesn't matter. Okay, but a number of people have argued that maybe it's a you really can't make such a neat split between the what and the why. And the why will often spill over into the what, and that's a good thing. Okay, so Rav Moshe Lichtenstein has an article about it. I have an article about it. So I would argue it's not such an easy split. That often in analyzing the why is going to be there. Yeah, David.
What do you think it is about an 8-day-old baby that makes it more mature than a 7-day-old baby?
Are you asking because they're only 1 day apart, or you're asking?
No. Well, I'm just saying because it's so close after a baby. That, like, what is that?
Look, I just want to point out one thing. Maybe this is not your question, David. Every cutoff point has a certain arbitrary quality to it. Right? Because you could always say, like, let's say the post office closes at 4, and you show up at 4:02. So you say to them, but it's only 2 minutes. Is there really a difference in the cosmos between 4 and 4:02? Yeah, but the post office is still closed. Right? It has to close at some point. Right? So there's some cutoff when we think the baby is now mature enough for the circumcision.
Right, so my question was more, what do you think the actual, like, maturity is?
Oh, meaning from a medical standpoint?
Not from a, it can't be from a conscious
standpoint.
So.
Yeah, I have no idea. Okay, yeah.
Do you think that Rav Chaim, as a matter of the question that I asked over there about, you know, like, why can't you just do it on the 9th day?
That was Zach's question. Yes.
Shabbat, yeah. So I think that would definitely depend, at least from my view, like, on if Rav Chaim views the obligation as starting from, like, when the baby is born, but then we don't do it until physical maturity level, in which case, immediately when physical maturity hits, you are required to do it, or when the obligation is always there, but we wait, right? Meaning, does the obligation...
You're saying maybe it's easier to address this question if kind of, like, it's almost like a Zrizim issue.
Yeah,
you should do it with alacrity. The first possible opportunity is important.
Exactly. If the first opportunity, you must do it, and then we make that 8th day, then that's why you can reach out, because then you're required.
Not bad.
But if it were that the obligation is always there, but then we just wait, then you...
What? Okay. I thought you looked familiar, actually.
Yeah,
why do you look familiar?
I was here for the summer program 2 summers ago.
Oh, that's right. Okay. What's your first name? Okay. Yeah, your brother, very exciting. Little brother pride. Okay. What do you think? Exactly. The actual almost answer?
It's a good answer. It sounds like... the thing is, it like,
no, if he'd be a Sparty Rishon, you'd love it.
Of course. I would expect your client to, like, to back up his answer with something that seems
okay,
like...
Okay. Fair. John?
I'm actually a little bit bothered by Shlomo's answer, I'm sorry.
Okay.
Because according to Rav Chaim's worldview, the second that you're ready to have a bris, like, that is when the chiyuv kicks in. So if that chiyuv would kick in on a Shabbos, on, like, the 14th day, you would think that he would make Shabbos for it.
I mean, John's saying if you medically delay bris, you should be in the same boat. It's still nothing, right, it's a very good point, John. You still have to say there's something magical about the 8th day.
Right. Right, okay.
All right, very good. Zach? Okay, yeah.
Is the mitzvah specifically on the action of the bris or having
a bris? Ah, very good. Well, God, we have a group of lamdonim here. Excellent. Okay, let's go back. I wasn't going to do it, but once it'll be raised, let's go back to the Sfas Emes. Yeah, Aryeh.
I was going to say, I'm really confused why we're so sure that the whole timing issue is at least somewhat reliant on about physical maturity that maybe.
We're not convinced, meaning it's just the Reb Chaim's trying to solve a problem. He thinks this will solve the problem.
No, I'm saying in Reb Chaim, where's his source for physical maturity being attacked?
I mean, you want to know where did he get it from, or where did I get it from in reading him?
No.
What?
Where's he get that idea from?
He says this will solve a problem, and maybe solving a problem already gives a justification.
Is there any reason to push the scale that way? Would that be the better answer than just saying, there's entire value in the
Okay, look, did he have other evidence to think this? I'm not sure. It's an interesting question. Okay, let's go back to the Sfas Emes, Mr. Jacob.
Thank you, possibly.
After, okay? Okay, I'm afraid you're going to quote another Yushalmi about calling him. Okay. Okay. Jacob Rockland, you're on the warpath today, Jacob. Okay, very good. All right, why do you quote the Rav Chaim?
He says that if a female gets pregnant without the physical signs of maturity after the age of 12, then technically she's an adulterer. Which would help us because he would say that I think what he's saying is even though the you don't see the physical, meaning we can't necessarily tell physical maturity without the age, but
because there's a chazaka that's 8 days old. So here also the same thing would be that because the woman was able to get pregnant, that even though we shouldn't have physical maturity signs, we're still assuming that she was.
Okay, interesting analogy. Where'd you get that from?
What?
Where'd you get that from? Okay, excellent. So you guys, listen to our Baruch Shalai Mitzurim, you'll become erudite and knowledgeable. Okay, let's go to this side of it. Now, he's isn't very clever in the second answer. I think, again, you'll see how in analysis of one thing, we've come to all kinds of other things. Right? This could have been a topic about women and law, but it turns out it conveys a lot about the nature of circumcision and different kinds of obligations. So let's see what he says here. He says Dovi's point exactly. Okay, so we go to... Okay, let's look at the end of the fifth line. End of the fifth line in the Sefer HaSemes. Why is it not time bound? A little grammar, right? Passive. You need to be. Right? Notice he didn't say you need to circumcise. You need to be circumcised. That is a very clever answer. What does he claim, guys? Think about the difference between taking a lulav and getting a brit milah. Okay, when I take a lulav, where is the mitzvah to be located? It is just in the action of taking a lulav. It is not an identity status. Okay, even if lulav is your favorite mitzvah, right? There's no thing of, oh, now you are a lulav Jew, right? Now you can get shlishi and maftar yonah, which you couldn't get beforehand, right? No, either you did the mitzvah you didn't, but it doesn't affect your status in the slightest, right? It's just an act that you do. Circumcision is kind of unique, maybe unique among all mitzvot, in that it's not only an act, but it has long-term implications for your status, right? There's a difference in Jewish law between a circumcised male and an uncircumcised male. But that means, in some ways, it shifts the focus away from the action of circumcision to the status of being circumcised. Now, if that in itself is where I would now focus, where I would focus the mitzvah, what could one claim easily? So it turns out that, does the mitzvah of milah apply in the nighttime? Absolutely. In what sense does it apply in the nighttime? Not that you would schedule a brit for the nighttime, but that your identity as a circumcised Jew would be different if you're circumcised, right? Would still apply in the nighttime, right? You'd have a different identity than you'd have. So I thought that was a very clever answer. So if you say it that way, right, that is a great answer to the day-night conundrum. Gabe Gross.
What's the actual mitzvah? Is there a mitzvah to do a brit milah? Is there a mitzvah to constantly having, to mean the status of having?
Well, isn't that part exactly the question we're asking right now?
Yeah,
so the Sfat Emet is highlighting the second theme. Look, you could say they're both aspects, but as long as you have the second aspect, right, I think you could argue that it's no longer time-bound. It really is a universal, ubiquitous mitzvah. Jonah Kay. Okay, very good. Very good. Surely.
What about the idea that you have a different case where even if you have a blessing,
very clever. Surely that was both relevant and clever. Excellent. Excellent. Okay, this surely is a good proof. It's hard to argue that it's just a result-oriented mitzvah, because if it was just a result-oriented mitzvah, then somebody who was born without a foreskin wouldn't have to do anything. Okay? Or someone who somehow got an inappropriate breed. Right? Or before, right? So you have a good point there. So I think you have to work out some kind of combination theory. That the action does matter, but also the result matters and the status and identity matters, and therefore you could look beyond the specific action. Sam, Shir Kali Hirshhorn, what do you got?
I think also runs into like the eighth problem you built for Shabbos.
The eighth, you mean Zach's problem?
Zach's problem.
What?
The same thing, as in if it's just about him having the status of a free meal, then why not push it off until after Shabbos?
Yeah.
So then you specifically have to go on the
eighth. Okay, so the truth is, I'm not sure it couldn't be answered, but I think on other grounds, I already have to concede that the action matters too. So let's say there's two themes in Brit Milah. There's the action of circumcising that matters, and then there's the status and identity of being circumcised. But once you have theme two, you could argue that this mitzvah includes non-time-bound elements. Okay, David Lushitz.
So first you say the opposite, that we'd want the baby to have some sort of level of bris on Shabbos, so that it could be like within the community, on like it's a...
And you're saying that when you make an identity, it becomes more urgent, not less urgent. Okay, interesting.
And then I think that's also interesting how it can't only be the status thing, because then you should be able to then do Brit Milah then.
It can't Correct. And look, okay, you're all pointing to the same thing, which is at some level the act has to matter also. Which that's correct. I concede. Hey, Tim Galper, you doing okay? How was Renata this week? It was good. Okay. Yeah, Yoni.
What's the compelling evidence that it's only about that Brit Mila is only about status?
Well, again, you're right, Yoni. I actually conceded that I'm not saying it's only about status, but I have compelling evidence that it's also about status. That I can do.
Oh, but it's mainly.
For example, guys, give me an example, guys. Where does it come up, whether you have a meal or not? What does it enable you to do? Okay. Right. With partaking of the Korban Pesach, it says, Kol Arel Lo Yochobo. If you're uncircumcised, you can't partake. So clearly, there's a status of being a circumcised Jew. It has different legal implications. Right, so I think Yoni's right again. Now guys, I'll throw in the towel. I'm not saying it's only result oriented. Let's say the action matters also, but I don't think that ruins the Sfas Emes. It's still that in lulav there's only action. Nothing else is going on but the action. In mila there's both an action and a result that matters, and the result matters in the nighttime and on Shabbat as well. Yeah, Jacob.
Isn't there? I don't know if it's proof for Shilly or Hensley.
By the way, this is your last comment, can you write? Okay. There's a rule in Shukla, you can only render reference three obscure sources.
Right.
Okay, so if you want to make a comment after this, it can't be an obscure source. Okay.
Doesn't the Gemara say that Shmua not to get a benefit from somebody who doesn't have a bris mila, anyone who's not Jewish and has a bris mila, you can get a benefit from, and anyone who's Jewish and doesn't have a bris mila, you can get a benefit from?
Yeah, except for one thing?
Yes.
Okay, let's raise this question about it, actually, because it's interesting what you just said. Okay, there's an interesting Gemara in the Dharma about a person takes a vow. Let's say a person takes a vow not to get benefit from the uncircumcised. Okay, so what do we have to do legally at that point? We have to define who the uncircumcised are. Can anyone tell me, though, why that might not be telling? It might not be common to our thing. You have to think about the nature of vows. Sam, what do you think?
Oh, this is about the nature of vows. More like you're not going to go around checking if this person's circumcised. You have a chazaka that Jews are circumcised and non-Jews.
Okay, but even a stronger point than that, guys. Why would vows perhaps be dependent on a different way of thinking about things? Okay, I'll give you a good example. Okay, you guys will love this one. What if I take a vow not to benefit from chashmal for the next 3 days? Okay, you guys with me so far? Okay, and then, okay, then we say, I'm a pretty religious Jew, so let's go to how chashmal is used in the Bible. How is chashmal used in Tanakh? Anyway, it's not electricity. What is it in Tanakh? Okay, so there's a famous vision that Yechezkel has of the divine chariot, Masa Merkava, and there seems to be some kind of energy force there referred to as chashmal. So let me ask a question. If I take a vow not to use chashmal, is it usher for me to use electricity now, or is it usher for me to, you know, use the divine energy force from that chariot? What do you think is usher for me?
Divine chariot.
Right, you guys are very biased. I would say electricity. Why? Because when I use the term chashmal, right, vows are not necessarily a function of the theoretical, you know, definitions. They're a function of human language. How do people speak, and what do they intend when they speak? So I think that case, Jacob Rockland, I think that you should isolate that case. That's just asking, what do people mean when they say uncircumcised? It's not asking about your legal status in a more profound way. Yeah.
I like the RL before.
Yeah. Why not? Okay, but could you imagine a halacha? Anybody who didn't take a lulav this year can't have to eat the Korban Pesach. Can you conceive of such a halacha? Wouldn't you say that's crazy? I guess not. I mean, I'm trying to show that it's not just a technicality. It shows that circumcision is part of essential identity. Think about the analogy. Right? We'll make a new law. Whoever skips Sukkot this year, you're out for the Korban Pesach. Right? It's hard for us to imagine such a thing. What? Okay, you only give me 2 minutes here. Okay. Actually, sorry, a little favoritism. Okay, just because we have a visiting brother. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm a little bit confused by the tension between the idea of status and this action because of the fact that the action is clearly on the person who does the bris mila. Because obviously, you don't do bris mila on yourself when you're 8 days old, but the status is on the child who's 8 days. but the child is not required in Nifut until, you know, 13. So therefore, I'm curious, is the requirement on the father that their child has to have the status of Brit Mila, or what's...
Okay, I'd say right now, I'm going to duck it for now. Okay, guys, let me take a 10-minute break from questions, and we'll come back to questions in 10 minutes. Okay, so let's just review what we've done so far in terms of the individual answers. So if we ask the question about day and not night, okay, so what's the simple answer of Tosafot? What does Tosafot say? Actually, after the time, it could be done at night. Obviously, that would neutralize the question. Okay, if we asked about the eighth day versus before that, what would Reb Chaim say? It's not really about day eight per se, it's about physical maturity. Okay, great. If we ask the Shabbat question, what would the Sfat Emet say? When Mila doesn't beat Shabbat, it's not because the mitzvah's not there. It just loses out, but the mitzvah's there. Okay, so that what I call like the piecemeal solution. We could give individual solutions to all of the dilemmas and try to work off that. We'll see in a second, perhaps a sweeping solution. Okay, but before we get to the sweeping solution, okay, I want to see one more thing. Okay, go to source 8. Okay, source 8 in the Turi Evan. This is a very clever point. Okay. Let's explain who this. The Turi Evan is the same author as the Shagat Aryeh. Okay, his name is Rabbi Aryeh Ginsberg. Okay, he wrote in the late 1700s, and he was one of the Rabbeim of Reb Chaim Volozhin. Who was Reb Chaim Volozhin's other teacher?
The Gra.
Very good. Okay, so his major works are Shagat Aryeh, which is Halachic Essays, and Turei Evan, which is his running commentary. Okay, it's on three Masechta. It's a very nice commentary. Okay, those of you learning Megillah this year, if you're looking for a little good analysis of Masechta Megillah, there is Turei Evan on Megillah. Okay, so you know, maybe just because of the interest of time, we'll do it outside. So he wants to differentiate between tefillin and mila. And he has a very good distinction. Again, what did we say? Tefillin would be a paradigm, perhaps, that if it doesn't apply at night, or it doesn't apply on Shabbos, that it's a zman grom. So let's try the night paradigm. So he says, tefillin is not like mila. Did anybody get to the source? Okay, why is tefillin not like mila? Sam? Very good. What happens, let's say I have a mitzvah to put on tefillin today, and I don't do it. Okay, now the nighttime comes. Now it's the next day, so I'm excited. I have my religious revival next morning, and I want to put on tefillin. So, did I fulfill the previous day's mitzvah?
No.
Each day is its own mitzvah. What does that tell you? That when nighttime comes, it ceases, right? The mitzvah is over. Okay, let's say I didn't get a brit milah on Tuesday. Now it's nighttime, I can't. What happens Wednesday? I can, but it's not a separate mitzvah. It's the same mitzvah. Meaning, you could view nighttime more as kind of like a little hiccup. It doesn't really stop the mitzvah. It just says, no, right now we're going to wait. This mitzvah is in abeyance until it comes back. So he wants to argue, maybe being time-bound is that the mitzvah comes to an end. But the mitzvah of circumcision really never comes to an end. Right? A Jew could do it at any point in his lifetime. It's true that he can't do it at night, but it's still the same mitzvah when you get to the next day. So I think it's also an important distinction. When you have a nighttime interruption, that could be because each day is an independent obligation. Or you can have a nighttime interruption because, okay, we don't do it at nighttime, but the same mitzvah is just lurking there in abeyance to be reawakened the next day. Maybe that's why it's not Zman Groma. Okay, you only actually, no, 5 more minutes, sorry. Okay, are we good at that? But again, that would be a little bit more of a piecemeal distinction in terms of answering it one by one. Okay, now we're going to try to move to a larger distinction. Okay, let's go back to the first side. Okay, maybe there's an answer that'll solve all three of them. Okay? Now we'll do it, we'll do both quantitative and qualitative. Okay, maybe we'll call it like the brute force answer and the qualitative answer. Let's go with the brute force answer. Okay, so if we go to Tosfot and Megillah, but it's also a good rule to realize for life, guys, you know, obviously Tosfot is a school and not an individual. So if you look at multiple Tosfot, right, there's no reason to assume they'll say the same answer. So often it's helpful, I saw Tosfot on this page, I'll try Tosfot on a different track, a different Masechet. Maybe there'll be a different suggestion. So here you have a different suggestion. Let's see, because again, we looked at Tosfot and Kiddushin. Tosfot and Megillah makes a different suggestion. So if we skip to the third line, he says, so I'm going to call it just the brute force suggestion. Why would someone think that Mila is different than other time-bound mitzvot? Because what do we know? Mila is a very unusual mitzvah. Normally in halacha, there's no punishment for violating a positive commitment, right? Punishments are only for prohibitions. There's no punishment for not putting on tefillin. There's no punishment for not studying Torah. There's no punishment from a court for, you know, not making kiddush. Positive commandments are not punishable in the court system. Okay, or not punished. I shouldn't even say the court system. See, there's no punishment listed in Tanakh at all. Okay, what are the two exceptions, of course? Carbon Pesach and Mila. So what could one say? I guess Mila ranks more in our tradition than other things we've discussed in the past. Oh, there's a great Rambam to remember, guys. Okay, so it's a good philosophical Rambam. Get this down. Okay, there's a mission of oath that says you should be careful about every commandment because we don't know how to rank the commandments. Now, you could take that as a general religious principle. We don't rank commandments. They're all equally significant. However, the Rambam does something very fascinating there in his commentary of oath. The Rambam says it's not really true. We do have a barometer for ranking the commandments. What's the barometer? Yeah, punishments. Is it an accident that some punishment, some crimes are death penalty crimes, some are lashes, some are monetary, some are no payment, right? Says Rambam, that's not an accident. That itself is a ranking system. You'd imagine that death penalty crimes are more serious than crimes that there's no punishment for, right? So at that point, the Rambam says, so when is it true that we can't rank mitzvot? Only for the positive mitzvot. That's what the Rambam suggests. But if the Rambam's right, if we would then take it one step further, what might we then argue? Oh, there are two mitzvot asay that apparently really rate. Apparently we really care about the Karban Pesach, and we really care about circumcision, about Brit Milah. So once that's true, what could you argue? Again, it's not such an exciting answer, but it might be true. Oh, there's more reason to create obligations when it comes to Brit Milah because it's got Karban. Right, so maybe we toss out all exemptions. Right, therefore a mom would be obligated. It's true it's a time-bound mitzvah, but who cares? There's a mitzvah that our tradition obviously cares greatly about. John Seidel.
So if you don't, do you get carried if you, like, every day or not?
That's actually a very interesting debate.
Is the carbon pesach, do you have pesach sheis?
Okay, so John is very interested in the question, actually debating the Rambam and the Raivad. Okay, if you, trying to think if I want to get into this now, with 13 minutes left. What do you say, John, should we do it? Okay. Now, there's a little bit tricky thing in Brit Milah, which is, let's say there's a punishment for violating it. When exactly does that kick in? Because, what could you argue? Let's say you're 37 years old, and I say to you, oh, you're a Jewish man, do you have a circumcision? You say no. So I say, that's not good, there's a punishment. What do you say to me? No, I'm planning on doing it when I'm 44, it's okay. Right? I may only do it once in my life, once I do it, it's done. Right? So, when do you say that someone has, at that point, violated the commandment? So what guys want to make a suggestion? What are the possibilities? Yeah, David? Oh, that's pretty clever, actually. No one says it, but it's very clever. Okay, yeah, I see. Okay, so there's two possibilities here. One is that once you're a halachic adult, once you're a legal adult, you are liable for that punishment. Right? Let's say 13 or 20, whatever you want to say, you're liable for the punishment for the rest of your life. And it could be it'll happen earlier, it'll happen later. Right? Depends on how divine providence plays out. But you are liable for the punishment. Okay, the other possibility is that you're only liable for the punishment when you die. Okay, so the Rambam and Raivad debate this point in Hilchot Milah. Can take it there, John? Okay, it might also depend on what you think Karet is. Because I have a great combination theory that would really make life great, but it doesn't work out well. Okay, you know, one theory of Karet is that you die a little bit earlier, like 5 years earlier. Now, if you combine that with a theory that you only chive Karet when you die, it's a great theory. Right, right, you guys understand? Okay, I'm not explaining it. Yeah, keep it. No, the person, it's not about the parent. I mean, it's true the father's obligated till the child's an adult, but then the obligation shifts to the child. And that's the obligation that has the real bite to it, as it were. Oh, yeah, Jonah?
Could you also just reformulate the Milah or Pesach as well as Asay, so you don't adopt two things?
Why can't you do that for every Asay?
Well, because they have an onus.
Wait, just because you have an onus, you're allowed to play with language like that?
I think this is what I'm just going to say.
Yeah. Oh, that was very clever. Do you understand what Aaron Priver just said? Is that what you meant? Is that what you meant, Jonah?
Not so well.
Okay. No, but maybe he took the germ of your idea. Do you understand what Aaron just said? Like, if we say that negative prohibitions have punishments and assays do not, maybe the fact that Mila has an assay should make us suspect it is somehow lotase-like. What would happen if it's lotase-like? Well, there's no exemption for women for any lotases. That's very clever. Okay, very clever. Yeah, Alec?
Isn't the Rambam's argument undermined by the fact that there are ase mitzvot that are quote-unquote ranked?
No, but maybe you could say as follows, that if everything has a ranking, then I could use it as a barometer. But if I only have two things that have a punishment, I don't have enough evidence. Like, I can't get a theory started. Right? You feel what I'm trying to say? Like, low test is like, I could go through all the negative prohibitions and rank them into four categories. Right? But asays, I only have two mitzvot that have any kind of evidence. Maybe at that point, I would just like step back and not make a theory about asays. Akiva Levy. How does the fact that yeah, it doesn't. No, it just shows that it's a mitzvah with more weight. That's the point. It's not that the mom's doing it to avoid karet, but it's a more weighty mitzvah. Okay, where's Gabe Shore? Is he in the back there? Gabe Shore, are you wearing a polo shirt? Okay, excellent. Guys, I have very little students. First year colleague Gabe is endorsing polo, and Akiva Levy's endorsing Burger King. Very excited. Okay, yeah, are you?
She said that for Pesach and Mila, is Mila considered Isser Asa?
I don't know. We would have to deal with that right this second. Yes, Dovi.
Are there any other mitzvot really that, like, it says the father is obligated to the Amokano, right? But he's not physically obligated to do so, he can pass on the
Oh, we'll get there right second. Okay. Dovi, you're like your second super lumpish comment in one day. Excellent. Okay, everyone go to the Tosfos. We're going to see one more thing here, guys, and try to wrap up the show. Everyone go to source 4. Okay? Just to clarify who this is, when we talk about the rabbinic authorities of the medieval period, we mostly focus on, you know, the Ashkenazi world of France and Germany and the Sephardi world of Spain. But there were also some important rabbis in Italy. Okay, the Tosfos read is Rabbi Yeshayo Detrani. Okay, so, okay, there was, oh yeah, Jacob Detrani's from his family's from the same city. That's correct. David Lewis, you're from Trani? Okay, there you go. Very cool. Okay, so here is one of your rabbinic ancestors. Have you been to Italy?
No, not yet.
Okay, what are you waiting for? Okay. He's go with Henry. He spends a lot of time in Europe. Okay? Okay. Here we go. So let us go to the... let's go to the Tosfos Rid. Okay, source 4. Okay, so skip to... Tosfos Rid, let's start with line. Okay, we're going to start with the line that gives the Eina Mitzvah. It's about the seventh line. You guys see that? Eina Mitzvah, El Isman Yaduah, Velo Bechazman, Ava Mitzvah, Delo Talia Begufa, Kagon Lamul Et Bena, Mitzvah to circumcise your child. Avagat the Milat HaBen Yesh Lezman, it does have a fixed time. Nehi Dekvua Hazman LeBen HaNimo. So the child has a fixed time, right? Day 8. Aval ha'av shetzivo ha'boi l'taseik b'milat b'no ha'esek ha'hu ein lo zman shebein b'yom ben b'layu yitrach v'yachin tzarchi milat b'no. So here's a fascinating theory. What is this? Before we talked about moving it away from the action to the result. But there's another way you could move it away from the action. What else could you say? The essence of it is not the action, but? The preparation. Right, maybe the parental obligation is not to do the act of circumcision itself, but to set it up. And the setting it up could be something, you call the moel, you order the bagels, whatever the case may be. Right, now clearly, why would that solve the problem? Why would that solve the problem? You said, Dovi, still your point, right? Because the setting it up is something that could take place at night, right? If the dad calls the moel at night, you wouldn't say, don't do that, we don't do meal at night. No, because you could set it up anytime. So I think it's quite fascinating. You have two different theories here that move the focus away from the action per se, but one moves it more to result-oriented mitzvah, that we saw in the Svat Emet. It's about your identity and your status. Or you can move it more towards the preparation. That's what you meant, right? But this can have tremendous implications, guys. Okay, don't think this is just a technicality. Here's the interesting implication. Some of you may know that when you have a brit, there are some fathers who want to be involved in the mitzvah because they claim it's their mitzvah. So I do not recommend this. So obviously, if the father's a mohel, they're in great shape. What if the father's not a mohel? They don't ever see someone do this. So nowadays, the mohel could kind of set everything up. The kind of the sense is like anybody could do it. Like you have like a guard there and everything set up. So even if you're not professional, right, the father will do it. You never see this. Okay, that's probably a good thing. Okay, so but what would be their argument? The people who do that. Well, if it's really a parental obligation, so the best way is do it yourself. Those who know Kiddushin, mitzvah bo, yoter mibishlugo, right? Do it by yourself. However, if Dovi is right and the Tosfos Rid is right, what would emerge? Is that a chumer or a silliness? Why? Because it's not a mitzvah on the father to circumcise his son. There's a mitzvah to make sure it happens. So if the mole doesn't, he's still making sure it happens. Right? There'd be no sense of losing out because he's not personally making the cut. Yeah. Max.
The keeping the mitzvah itself still has to be during the day, right? I mean,
look, sure let me clap everyone here, guys. No one's denying. We're going to have the same problems we had before with the Sfas Emes. You can't totally divorce it from the action. Because obviously the action has parameters and limitations. So I don't think anyone could argue that. We don't really care about the action. But you could still do one of two things. You could still say, beyond the action, there's a result and a status. And that's the Sfas Emes' point. And you could say, sure, the action has to happen. But the essence of the parental obligation is more the arrangements and not the action per se. Right? You're right. No one could say, well, the action doesn't really matter. But obviously that's not true. It has its own limitations and parameters. But you can say, what's the dad's essential obligation? The arrangement. And that's not a time-bound obligation. Yoni?
Couldn't you say then that if a woman marries a non-Jewish man, and then they give birth, so the baby's Jewish, so wouldn't it be the obligation of the mother to get the son of Brit Milah?
That's clever. A very clever question. Or you could default to the Beit Din at that point.
But then the mother has to make sure it goes to the Beit Din.
Let me ask a question. What if there's a Jewish orphan boy, right? And there's no father or mother, right? Wouldn't the Beit Din have to get involved, right?
Yeah, but that's a different question.
Okay. What if I think it's the same question?
What if the mother is in the picture, though?
Is that on the mother?
Look, you're certainly right in terms of broader Jewish values. Obviously, we'd expect mom to take care of it. Does that translate into concrete halakhic obligations? Is a separate question. Okay, in terms of broader Jewish values, you're certainly correct. John?
Don't we see in the previous parsha that when Tzipora gave Brit Milah, it was like, not that it was, it was on the eighth day, it was like a need to be on that day. They couldn't wait, a week or so to get out of Egypt.
That's very John Seidel, very good. I should have moved on, guys. Yesterday we did a review of all the times Milah appears in Breishit. I should have asked all the times Milah appears in Shemot. That would have been an exciting question, too. Okay, so what should we derive from the Tzipora story is an interesting question, but with 3 minutes left. Oh, you've been bringing Yoshua. Oh, John, what's going on here? Wow, where does Milah appear in Yecheskel, John? I'm just kidding. Yeah, you got it, Isaac. You're saying that should be an argument for the women. It does come up in that Gemara, though. Okay? It does come up in that Gemara. Okay, last two comments. David.
Is a father allowed to prepare for a meal on Shabbos from Yom Tov?
What a good question. With or without an Erev Tavshilin. We'll discuss that some other time. It's a good question. Yeah.
Based on the father's idea of sort of trying to divorce it to become results oriented as opposed to action oriented, how does that have to do with the situation on Grandma based on the fact that a woman is not obligated for herself to have the status of Milo because she can't? So therefore, what's the point of divorcing it to make it non-resistance for Angama? Because of the fact that the only way we would make a woman have anything to do with Mila is only has to do with the action or the preparation, right? But it's nothing to do with the status, because the status would only ever be on the bed anyways. So what's the point of doing that in any case? Because she has nothing to do with it anyways.
I understand your question. I wish you had asked it 5 minutes ago. Okay, so I'm going to ignore it. Okay, Aaron, I should do a review at the end. I'd like to do a little review. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, right, I forgot one answer. Right, the Sfas Emes at one point suggests that maybe mitzvot that were pre-Matan Torah have a different status. Okay, that's also a possibility. They're looking like, what would make Milah different than other things? You want to be a mention that? You want to have a question about it? Yeah. You're asking a great question. You're saying, how should I deal with a mitzvah that exists both pre-Matan Torah and post-Matan Torah? And you want to know, does the post-Matan Torah obliterate the pre-Matan Torah status? Is that your question? It should be. It's a good question.
Yeah, that's part of the question, but also, I would think it's
meditation. I'm sorry?
I would think it's meditation.
He's saying... Okay, I understand. Okay, let's give Jordan a chance. Jordan.
Where does Tosfot bring up... How does he get to the idea of preparation being, part of it?
Well, again, think about it. There's something a little bit unusual here in that I'm supposed to arrange something for you. And... or even just think about some of the other pals. What else is a father supposed to do for a child? Teach him Torah. Right? Wouldn't you say something similar there? Do you have to do it directly, or maybe hire the best tutors, right? It could be these are more... But there's a parallel here, because I think they're more goal-oriented mitzvot.
But how is that preparation? I feel like that's the action.
Well, if I ask somebody else to teach my child, I'm setting it up, right? I'm not doing the actual teaching. Right? All right, brief summary, last thing, guys. I'm not going to review the whole share. So again, we discussed three reasons why Mila might be Zman Grama. Again, they were?
Day.
8 days, day and a night, and Shabbat Shalom Bizmana. Okay, we had piecemeal solutions we're not going to review. It's going to review the total solutions. Right, instead of solving it in a piecemeal approach, you might say, I've got a more global point about Bar Mila. Okay, what did the Tosfos and Megillah say? Why might Mila be different? Because it's the only assay that has kare, that gives it more force. Okay, then we said, as Aaron points out, this is maybe Mila is different because it precedes revelation. It's pre-Matan Torah, could work with a different rule book. Okay, but then we had two really fascinating answers. This is my biggest focus here, guys, which is the Sfas Emes versus the Tosfos Rish. According to the Sfas Emes, how should we think about the mitzvah of Mila? Don't think just about this action. Think about an identity and a status that emerges. There's a difference in law between circumcised and not, and that is not time-bound in the slightest. So that's moving from the action to the result. What you, in the Tosfos Rish, you get the opposite. Tosfos Rish says, don't just think about the action. Think about... What does Ritz say? Think about the preparation. What's dad's obligation? To get things ready. And that's something that could happen in the day or at night. So I think, again, notice we started with a women's question here, but it went into all different directions about how we understand Mila, how we understand the concept of a time-bound mitzvah. So, yeah. Okay, there's a lot more to say here, but we will now give over the floor to Rav Moshe.
Okay, just before we start, Mincha,